Welcome to the highlights of the Circular Republic Festival, Europe's leading event for advancing the circular economy, uniting corporates, startups, and innovators driving this transformation. We continue this series with a panel about extended producer responsibility. The panelists are Steffen Gerlach, founder and CEO of Eden, Julia Haas, Project Manager, Business Development, Circular Textiles at Interzero. Marie Navrogi, Legal Advisor for Sustainability Law and Product Conformity at Decathlon. And Sophie Herrmann, Partner and Managing Director Germany of Systemic. This conversation is moderated by Karl Wackentin, Founder of the Circular Textile Platform at Circular Republic. But before we start, I have an offer for you. If you want to get the actionable one-pager of this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm.
Well, they just launched yesterday. Some of you may have been attending the opening session for that. It's called the Textile Recycling Breakthrough and calling for strong policy action to unlock the recycling market. So please welcome our guests on stage. You sit wherever. Okay. So, Julia, first question goes to you. What do you think makes Interzero enter the textile industry? It's for you a new industry to enter. We have this project together. So what is the decision? What makes Interzero decide going into this market?
Yeah. I hope everybody can hear me. So for those who might not know Interzero as a player, maybe one or two sentences of what we're doing. Generally speaking, we are a circular economy service provider in different kind of fields or material streams, very much focused on the one hand on regulatory business. So we are usually one of the PROs or systems when it comes to EPR in packaging space, in the battery space, in the consumer electronics space, wherever we have EPR models on the market. And on the other hand, we are also partly vertically integrated. For example, when it comes to packaging or plastics, we have our own sorting operations on the German market, sorting a part of what kind of lightweight packaging is coming back, and then distributing that or procuring that to recyclers. And then we have many other business models, but that is basically where we're coming from, let's say. And also the background why the textiles market is so interesting for us, because 2 or 3 years ago now, we saw or we heard from the EU legislation that an EPR will be coming up for textiles, which already makes us a very interesting market for us because it's our background where we're coming from, being one of the PR also EPR system providers. So from that side, of course, we wanted to use that know-how, see how the market evolves, see what we can do and how we can apply what we're already doing to that space. And on the other hand, we're seeing, you already said it, a big shift in the infrastructure. We know how the infrastructure is working today, and this is not the infrastructure that we need for tomorrow for the EPR to take place or to be run in a proper way. And there's a big gap, especially in the sorting infrastructure from our perspective, where we're coming from, to be able to procure recyclers such as Eden, but also others, with the right materials. Since this kind of sorting infrastructure is not existing, the whole sorting infrastructure is very focused on sorting for reuse, but there's basically none existent for sorting for recycling, and that's one of our core businesses. So for us, it was a good field or a good space and a good momentum now to go into that market with these two kind of expertises and apply that to the textile space and see how can we help scaling that infrastructure and bring a system that in the end will provide the right material on the one hand and compliance for brands on the other.
Right. Thank you very much. Sounds like a logical step to enter the textiles industry. Marie, Decathlon has been a very strong advocate for circularity and sustainability. From a producer's perspective, right, what are the most important levers brands can pull today to adapt to the new regulations for sustainability, just like the EPR scheme?
So that's a great question. Thank you. Well, first of all, of course, you can think about the basics, right? Where you conceptualize your product and think about circularity in the end as well, like to already think at it from the beginning, you know, like, will it be able to be recycled? Can it be repaired, etc.? We have had some experience with that. For example, we have undyed products, undyed tent or such products, or we are also thinking about how products can be repaired and increasing the expertise in repair. And I think this is the second really important point, is to be ready for new business models, as it was already a little bit mentioned, that I think it's really key now to focus and to think ahead a bit away from the classic retailing perspective and more what can we do, what kind of business models can we implement. Like, for example, we have a big focus at Decathlon right now on the repair side. We have implemented regional workshops, etc., to repair the products and be able to provide this to the customers. But also, for example, buying back products from our customers to get that feedstock rather than sourcing it in raw materials or something. And I think the third point is also what Julia already mentioned, which has become more important nowadays, is to really have, you know, the anticipation of the laws and the regulations and not be surprised when they're in force or just comply to it when they're in force, but rather have a strong legal monitoring already at the start to see where is the development going. And because we can see that the development is also changing, right? We have this with the omnibus proposals, etc., that it's always changing. So it's good to have that awareness and be proactive as a player, I guess, and creating synergies with other players.
Steffen, we know each other now for a while, and you just raised a Series A round. It's official now, so congrats again for this. Thanks. So obviously, the industry and also investors trust your business model and in the fact that you can scale your recycling business. We also had a podcast episode recorded together where you also mentioned that your business model and no business model should, you know, be based on regulatory alone, right? So there's a big business model behind. But what needs to happen beyond policy, right, for you, for your business idea to scale, and how important actually is the EPR scheme for your business model?
Yeah, I would say, generally speaking, there's the most important aspect is high volumes of reliably sorted textile waste, because all the recyclers are focused on developing products that are a drop-in solution to existing spinning or processing methods, and that's the development goal. And if you can actually reach that point, then the offtake is supposed to be easier in terms of product integration into existing systems. But since we have a gap today in between the actual sorting and collection, how it takes place today, and the sorting and advanced sorting that needs to be happening for recyclers, I think that's the biggest risk from both perspectives. And it's very important that a joint ramp-up effort and synchronized in terms of timeline takes space. Because if a player like InterZero ramps up their efforts in advanced sorting, but the recyclers are not ready to take it off, it's a huge chunk of the risk on their side. And vice versa. Also, if we ramp up our technologies, but the advanced sorting is not there yet, it poses a huge risk on those recycling technologies to sustain the period up until that is up and running. And I would say that's the first and foremost important aspect. And the second one that we find always quite surprising is information sharing around the materials, right? Design for recycling is a, let's say, flying word out there, but what does that actually mean, and who knows what is in those products? And from my experience, mostly the brands don't know, and the suppliers are hard to reach in that regard or don't want to share the information. But that's a big challenge for recyclers, going from very heterogeneous feedstock to a very homogeneous product, and you're basically developing your process blind in that regard. There are some things you know, some things you can analyze, but then there's many things that you don't know, and you just see what happens to your process if something is in there, and then the search begins on what is in there. And I think if we have more transparency around that, in order to then increase the effort on design for recycling, we can have a huge lever on unit economics and the overall circularity increase in terms of recycling.
Sophie, you just launched your report yesterday, and you state in that report that EPR scheme is an important lever to scale polyester recycling. Can you run us through, you know, the most important findings of your report?
Yeah, thank you. Happy to. And just to quickly say, where there is this screen in the back, I put a little flyer, and it has the QR code, so you can also, if you're interested, easily access the report. What is it about? And I think something I want to mention why it's actually quite special, this piece of work, is because we worked, we wanted to model the whole textile value chain, and we actually worked with different players along the value chain, including InterZero, and with actual data. Because the whole idea was actually to understand what can make this system viable. And the methodology that we followed is called a tipping points methodology. And it basically assumes, when you think of cars or cell phones, there is one pointing here right now, how far at some moment they completely took off. Yeah, there was a ramp up period, and then at some moment there is a, it follows an S curve, and at some moment the take up of a new technology goes up exponentially. And that was basically the logic that we were following to understand where is that point in the S curve when exponential growth can start. And there are three necessary conditions that need to be met for such a takeoff. And one is the affordability, so that it's as cheap or cheaper than the incumbent solution. Second, that it's attractive, so that means the quality also needs to be good of the product. And then thirdly, it needs to be accessible, so there needs to be sufficient volume that actually a market can really demand that that product. And as I said, we modeled that with actual data along the whole value chain, so from collection, sorting, through the recycling, and the offtake. And what we see today is that polyester, we did that for polyester, that recycled polyester is 2.6 times more expensive than the virgin polyester. And so how do you overcome such a steep or big difference in cost? And then we looked at different levers. So what if we collect better, sort better? And we came also then to basically how do you create the volumes? How do you create economies of scale? But there is a point at which you need that EPR fee that is extremely important to bridge that remaining price gap. And so we can also talk about how high it needs to be, but there's much more in the EPR fee than just the money and financing that system. The EPR fee can have, and I think, Stefan, you mentioned it, on the design side, extremely important if it's modulated, that you actually get better design that leads to better sorting and better input for the system, for the recycling system. So the EPR fee, you know, really has already the first effect when it comes on the design, if it's well done. Then, of course, it finances the sorting, the collecting, the sorting, the recycling process, but it also de-risks the whole investment and all the infrastructure that needs to come, because there needs to be confidence in the market to even build that infrastructure. And an EPR fee can do that because it's a market creating mechanism and gives the confidence that actually a product will be there that can be put at the market at a, let's say, at least equivalent volume, quality and price as the virgin material. So that's what we looked at in that work.
Well, thank you for putting that work in, and thank you for supporting that work, Julia, with InterZero. Obviously, you entering the textile market now makes you probably look at the entire value chain, and all of us are, I think, pretty aware that a lot of collectors and sorters are facing some serious challenges these days. How do you look at that, and how do you think we can, you know, improve their situation?
Yeah. Very difficult question, and also very complex question, because I think what we're seeing right now, the market development that we're having right now, is something that has not been in that regard there before. At the moment, or the way it looks right now, is that collection and sorting is not financed through the process that comes afterwards or the trading anymore. which has been the case for the past 20 or 30 years. And now we are suddenly seeing a shift because qualities are going down or are not reaching these kind of sorters anymore who were very much relying on high quality material that can be resold as reused goods. Doesn't mean that these are gone. They just go into different markets. There's still a secondhand market, which is growing. There's a peer-to-peer market, which has been growing. We're all selling our own things that are high quality, that have a good price because we know that they have a good price and we want to sell them ourselves. But that also means also with the rise of fast or ultra fast or even real-time fashion, however you want to call it, with Shein and Temu, that lots of material comes on the market that cannot be resold in a very good quality. So the collectors and sorters, especially the sorters, are struggling very much with that because their sole business models is reliant on that kind of material. So for now, the question is, how does that continue? Since, especially from the German perspective, we do have an installed infrastructure. We do have collection infrastructure. It's very historically grown, but it is out there. And now we have the chance, or maybe shifting a little bit from the problem space that we are in right now to what can we do with that. We have the chance to use that right now. The question is, how do we do that and how do we bridge the gap from today, 2025, to 2028, 2029, when the EPR is coming? Because there is a gap of 3 years. And if we're not doing anything, the infrastructure won't just hold up for the next 3 years. So I think the important point is, I'm not here and can tell you this is the solution, let's go for that. But the important point is that we find a ramp up or we find a milestone plan together with the industry, with brands, with sorters, with recyclers, with collectors, to find a way to bridge this gap together, to somehow collaboratively build something such as we are doing with Circular Republic, but we'll probably come to that in a moment, to really see how can we make this business model work, how can we transform it to the future, what are the relevant milestones, and how can we not just let it break down for the next 3 years and then we would have to build it up again, but how can we consolidate, collaborate, and really bring that or bridge that gap together rather than just say, okay, for the next 3 years we're not doing anything and then we're building it from scratch again, because the infrastructure is there. We just need collaboration and consolidation to finance that through these next 3 years.
Right. And do you want to share a little bit already what we are doing in our project together? I mean, it just started. We just had the first kickoff workshop in March. But maybe share a little bit of what our goal is and where we stand.
Yeah, for sure. So having said that now, we strongly believe at InterZero that we cannot wait for 3 years. As I already mentioned, we have to do something now. And also the time to build this infrastructure and to use the infrastructure that is out there is now, since we know from building EPR schemes it takes about 3 or 2.5 years to build the infrastructure that needs to be there as soon as the EPR scheme is entering into forces. So we decided together with Circular Republic to build an industry initiative that is bringing together the relevant stakeholders along the value chain, not only the brand's perspective, not only the waste management perspective, but really all of these perspectives to create a solution we call industry solution. So really a solution from within the industry rather than a solution that comes from the policy space, and make a recommendation on what the system can really look like and build something voluntary for the next 3 years, because we strongly believe that this is also necessary in order to have an influence. If we wait for 3 years and we let policy do their thing, we don't know how that goes and we don't know if it's the best for the industry and the infrastructure that we need. So we believe that we should make that recommendation and we should come together, we should bring the opinions together. In the end, we will have to find a solution that kind of works for all of the players that are involved, the brands that will in the end pay, the sorters and collectors that will have the infrastructure, that will do the infrastructure, and also in the end the recyclers that would take material. So we really want to use the space together with Circular Republic to create that solution and go from the talking stage really into a pilot stage, testing it, calculating it, what will it actually cost also for the next 3 years, because that's also a very big question, make that really quickly in a pilot scale and then see how we can ramp that up together.
That's an exciting project, and everyone who's interested to learn more about it, obviously happy to talk these days about it. Marie, we just heard it now from Julia, right? The producers are supposed to pay the extended producer responsibility fee. First of all, I mean, you represent the producer, so how is that perceived within the producer industry that you are basically being asked to pay for it? And then there is a lot of, you know, like there are two industry perspectives, let's say, that you have the waste managed industry who maybe has an idea of how it could look like. The producers have maybe a bit little different idea. How is that debate going on from a producer's perspective? And how do we make sure that we in the end get an APR scheme that is actually really doing good and not just, you know, the stronger lobby wins in the end, but that it actually serves the purpose?
Yeah. I don't know if I can speak so much about how it's viewed by the producers in general, because I can just tell you how it's viewed at Decathlon. At Decathlon, we really are in line with the need to have an EPR for textiles, and we really support it as well. I think the biggest question is really on how it will implement it, and this is where we... we want to rely on the politics, but also not only, and as Julia also mentioned, provide our own expertise and our own insights on how this should look like. So I think one of the most important points is really how the fee will be allocated to different stakeholders in the end, because there, I think, well, what we all want is the EPR to be effective in terms of environmental impact and not in terms of raising administrative resources. And so I think it's really key to keep in mind how the fee will be in the end allocated, but also in a proportional way, like which stakeholders should get how much proportions of the fee. Because, for example, one question is, if we have stakeholders that already rely on a business model that is already working, then maybe the fee allocation should be less or not existent, but rather support industries or stakeholders like sorting mechanisms that are not funded at the moment. So I think it really all depends on how it will be implemented. And this is why I totally agree with Julia that we have to be anticipatory and really put ourselves out there to challenge maybe what is also implemented. We've learned from past EPRs, I think, both good and bad things, or we can learn what we can do better. And I think one of the key levers is, or key stakes, let's say, is that it will be harmonized within the EU, because this is something that has caused, at least for us, problems, because I think most of the operators don't operate in one country, but rather in several EU countries. But currently we have a directive proposal. So again, we have the risk that it will be a directive that needs to be transposed into different national laws. And I think this is something that we should really put a focus on to avoid these kind of risks in the future. Yeah. And to make an impact, to answer your question.
Right. I mean, that's what we're here for. Stefan, you are obviously, I think, benefiting from the EPR scheme as a key player, as a recycler. What are the challenges that you face in scaling your technology? I mean, you already talked a little bit about feedstock is one big option that you need to address. And what I also really liked in all our conversations is you're really looking at the entire value chain, right? So like, so now you addressed already feedstock as a challenge, but at the same time, who is actually your customer? Do you try to get offtake agreements from a yarn producer or from a fabric producer or from the brands? Like, it seems like you're very integrated into the entire value chain, even though you're, you know, just as a acting as a recycler.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting and for me also fascinating aspect of our company, that talking to many stakeholders in circularity always makes a lot of sense. And I think that doesn't only apply on textiles, but on other industries as well. For us, we were focusing the last couple of years mostly on the direct off-taker, so the industrial player that takes our material. In our case, we are focused on polyester and cotton in the mix. We like to have a little bit more cotton in the mix and a little bit less polyester. So there's basically two downstream value chains that we need to address. And the direct offtake is A, the chemical industry processing the monomers that we extract, so the basic building blocks of the polyester, to further process that, and the cellulose, and then talking to the cellulose fiber producers, because that's the main point of validation for us in terms of product quality and having a stable product quality. But once it comes to the textile value chain, it's quite interesting for us that basically any player along the value chain can sign offtake agreements with us. Sometimes it's the brand trying to secure material facing regulation or wanting to focus on their internal strategies in the end, and then promoting the offtake agreement to their supplier along the value chain. And sometimes it's, let's say, a random player somewhere along the value chain that has a customer that wants to have a recycled fiber share in their material, and then they come to us and talk to us about that because they have some sort of demand in their value chain. So I think if you can leverage that right, it can be an advantage. But that only goes into the direction of offtake and who is our customer. I think where we are still lacking behind is transparency and sharing information and joint action. I can give you an example outside of fashion. We're working, for example, with industrial washing companies. They buy and own textiles, and they rent it or lease it to hotels, to hospitals, for example. And when we speak to them and test their material for recycling and be like, yeah, here we have the challenge of, you said it's only polyester and cotton, but then there's a little bit of polyamide in there. Where is that coming from? Is it like the tack in there? And they're like, yeah, well, we don't care. We can change that. We just go for polyester cotton, pure in the future, easy to integrate. And then it was like one meeting with the managing directors of one of the leading players in Europe, and it sounded very easy. Okay, so we can just switch that. And I think that's, even though it might be more complex in other product categories, a general perspective that the industry needs to adopt more, that circularity is not only sorting and not only recycling and not only reuse and design for recycling. It's all of that, and we need to talk more about that. And I think there's other industries that are better in that regard. And I think that is, aside of feedstock sourcing and collection for us, something where the industry doesn't use the leverage on potential optimization of that setup.
Right, thanks. Sophie, there's this tension about what are producers willing to pay and what does the waste management industry say they need. I think you came also up with a number how high that EPR fee should be, and do you see that it's possible for producers also to pay this kind of fee?
Yeah. Maybe before I throw a number at you, just to say how important that offtake is. Yeah, I think there is setting the EPR fee and getting that right for the system to work. Like you also said, Marie, like how do you attribute it towards the chain? And we looked at that, but that offtake is so important to bridge also this time until the EPR fee is actually in place and the system is actually running in terms of distributing that fee. We did calculate that. The way that we calculated it is basically looking at all the costs along the value chain. And then before setting that, we basically saw how can you reduce that cost along the value chain through different levers. And I think that's the important thing. Yeah. So if we have better collection, if we have better design and have more good materials that go into the system, how does that change the economics? If we de-risk the investment, how much does that bring down CapEx cost over time, and what's the influence of that? Also reducing energy costs, obviously a big objective in Europe. So if you manage through renewable energy, through other policy mechanisms to bring down energy costs, what does that change in terms of the overall systems cost? That one is not a big one, but basically we looked at all of these to understand then what is the remaining gap of what I mentioned initially, these 2.6 factor of Asian virgin polyester versus recycled recycled polyester here in Europe. And what we found is what is needed in 2035 is roughly 330 euros per ton. Then we also said, because most of the production happens in Asia, but the consumption happens in Europe and, of course, the US, we have a very large waste volume. So and we don't produce so much, so basically you would need to ship that back. Yeah. And basically what we found is we had these 330 euros per ton in an EPR fee, and then put as a green premium on the producer the 55 on average per ton that it cost to ship that material back to where actually textiles are produced. So that gives us 385 euros per ton, roughly. And then we made a calculation just to illustrate, yeah, what does it mean? If you put that on a sweater, the sweater would roughly be 15 cents more expensive than it is today. And that's roughly a 5% premium on the material. I had the chance to be at the Sustainable Textiles Conference, I think 2 weeks ago in Amsterdam, and there was somebody, I don't need to name the brand, but some big brand here from Germany speaking and saying a one-digit premium they should be able to absorb. Yeah, so I think with that, I really hope that, yeah, that that EPR fee can be put in place and that we can reach that tipping point to make that system viable.
All right, that sounds very promising. Thank you for sharing this. I have a question kind of to all of you, and I would love all of you to answer it. We do always talk about EPR, right? Like, which is taking care of the whole infrastructure part from collection, sorting, and recycling of garments. But that's not the whole story, right? We also have to look at how are actually the products designed, and are they made, you know, more durable, more sustainable material, recycled material, etc.? And only this gives the holistic picture. So, but in up to you guys' opinion, to which extent should both models be, you know, combined or integrated with each other, or is it like something we have to look at in a completely separate way? Julia, maybe.
Yeah, to start. Sure. So also very interesting question. I always think that, of course, it makes sense to integrate that. We have the eco-modulation on the one hand, which will also help producers who maybe produce mono material that in the end help recyclers, or durable material, et cetera, and integrate that and give them an advantage in the end also when it comes to EPR. So for sure, it's two things that need to go hand in hand kind of within the system to help to make it attractive, to also incentivize producers to have a look at the design, to really see what can we make better in order to maybe pay less on the other side and kind of have a balance in between that. So I mean, from my perspective, it can and has to go hand in hand as well, even though we will have to see how that goes, because the discussions, especially on eco-modulation, are very, very complex, because when you look at the product range that we have and then really defining what is durable, what is recyclable, it's super complex to really make a definition based on, we have 100,000 million type of products. So we will see how that goes. But if we find a definition that is working and that can be used as incentivation for producers, this is definitely something that is interesting and will also go hand in hand with the EPR. And on the other hand, the EPR can also help that vice versa. So I think both will be very important, but one might be a bit more complex than the other. Not saying that EPR is not complex at all, but both are focused on also different parts of the value chain. So very, very good integratable, basically. Yeah.
How do you see it from a producer point of view?
I agree with this integration part, because I think when we look at the impact that we want to generate, we need for it to be based on studies like you conducted, for example, scientific studies, to know exactly how and what will impact in the best way. And so I think integrating both is the only way to really have reliable scientific evidence about what actually makes an impact. I think as an addition, because you mentioned definitions, I think it's really a complex topic, but again, we can see the necessity to have this streamlined at the politics level, right? We need to streamline the EPR regulations with other regulations that already have definitions on what is a more sustainable product, for example. So I think it's the only way to make it a little bit less complex.
For sure.
Maybe if I may just add one aspect to that, because you talked a lot about how the product should look like, yeah, what is inside in terms of making it recyclable. I would also add that it really needs to have recycled content and that that should also be part, because it's such an important market incentive and driver for
and
actually.
That's then really important again for, you know, yeah. Stefan's market.
Yeah,
exactly. That's right.
And not only for us as a company, but again, from a systemic perspective, if you want so, I think it makes a lot of sense if you think of the customer in the end, the consumer, right? If we now implement certain aspects that will make the product more expensive because we as society have not managed to develop circular systems yet and need to incorporate the end-of-life aspect into the price of the product, I think that's very much necessary. But if we then incentivize and show to the consumer, well, now it's becoming less expensive again because a certain brand or collaborative group of companies has managed to make it more circular, more sustainable, and therefore the product becomes cheaper again. That's also from a systemic perspective something that can be an even stronger driver than increasing the cost of the product to the level that it actually has because it's purely linear at the moment.
All right, we're perfectly in time. I think we now have still 5 more minutes for some questions from the audience. If there's anybody there, we should also have a microphone somewhere. Yes.
Yes, thank you. Daniel Kauter from Eurales. I have a very interesting discussion. Thank you. I have a question for Sophie. You were saying that if we increase the cost of the green premium of 5%, then that only leads to 15 cents increase. Is that correct?
Yes. So that's the premium that comes on top of the EPR fee is what we calculate, and that's the equivalent of the shipping cost of the recycled material from here to Asia.
But if you're in the recycling business yourself, then you look at typical offers. They require 2 to 3 times initially the cost of raw material in comparison to virgin material. How can you accommodate such a huge difference, at least in the beginning?
So of the EPR fee that we calculated, which is 330 euros roughly, right? And then the premium that I mentioned is just 55 on top, okay? That's the shipping equivalent. And of these 330, 60% are actually the recycling cost. So it is the vast majority of the cost of the system is actually the recycling.
Yeah, but if you do that, if you count rough $1,000 per ton and you add 300 something, so 30%, very rough numbers, that doesn't make 200-300%.
No. These numbers, we can take it offline. These numbers don't add up exactly like that because one are input costs and the other one is actually waste volumes and the cost of managing these waste volumes. And they are lower than the initial input. That's why these numbers will not exactly fit, but we can look at that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Maybe I have a question if there's no one else. We are not the first one now in Germany coming up with an EPR scheme, not in the textile industry and not in general. So do you, anyone wants to answer that? Can share maybe some best practice examples or bad experiences where we can learn from within the industry, within the textile industry from other countries, or even within Germany, the packaging industry or something, other industries where we can learn from that we maybe set it up this time a little bit different.
I can start. I would say the fragmentation is something that we need to move on from because the fragmentation between the countries and in Germany, even sometimes between the regions, is adding a lot of resource, or it's really resource intensive, so it's adding a lot of work, but doesn't increase the impact. So I think this is something that we should move on from.
100% agree to that. I think fragmentation all over Europe and then within the countries is a very big topic, especially from a brand's perspective when you're selling to all 27 European countries. And if you have to see or have a look at 27 different systems, and we already see that, unfortunately, also in the textile space, when we look at France, at the Netherlands, at Latvia, at Hungary, all of the four countries already have different systems. So that's definitely something that needs to be streamlined to make it easier and less complex. And also looking at existing systems such as in the Netherlands or in France, we can also, from the textile space, see what can we learn from that. Because in France, for example, the system is installed since 2007-2008. And we don't hear a lot of good things, like the market has increased and everything is working very well and perfectly fine. So I think we can use that as an example, have a look at that and see what didn't work, where did the money or where did the fee actually go? And coming back to what you said, how can we allocate it to support the infrastructure in the correct way in the future, to support where we want to go to towards recycling? And also, looking at the Netherlands, last point, we've seen that policy has taken action, which is great. They were moving forward and it's installed and implemented now. But the infrastructure wasn't ready, which again leads to the point that if we now have 3 years to go, we should really start working on the infrastructure now in order to make it ready when the EPR is installed and not just finance the existing infrastructure for financing's sake, but really build something up front.
And maybe to add one more word about that, I think what would be quite interesting is not have one steady number. I think in your report it's also a steady number for 2035. And in the Netherlands, for example, we talk to players that think the number that they set is too low, and it's lower than the number that you're proposing. And I think the development of the industry is fluent, and it's not totally linear. So it would make sense to have even a higher EPR fee probably in the beginning, and maybe decrease it over time and readjust that number rather than having a steady number based on assumptions today that we project into the future in terms of 2035, and maybe things have changed by then.
I completely agree, yeah? And it's supposed to be indicative so that we get an idea of you know, where is it. And it's not, we also believe it's not the Dutch number that is around 120 or something.
Yeah. Thank you so much, everybody, joining me here on stage today. It puts me in a very positive mood that especially from a producer and waste management industry point of view, there's a lot of common ground, which is, I think, very important for the next conversations in implementing an EPR scheme in Germany. Thank you very much for joining us today, and enjoy the next program.
This was another episode in our series about the Circular Republic Festival 2025. If you want to get the actionable one-pager about this conversation, please sign up to the Circularity FM newsletter. You can find it at www.circularity.fm. Let's drive a profitable circular economy. And please don't forget, the most abundant renewable resource is your imagination.
My name is Patrick Hübscher, and this is Circularity FM, the podcast about understanding, building, and managing circular business models.